My first question is, how did the idea come about to travel and search for hockey around the globe in its purest form?
I was just like, curious about the world in general, really. And I'd done a bit of traveling, but certainly not to the extent. I had actually read a story in one of the newspapers in Canada, the National Post, about a fellow who had gone to Mongolia to play outdoors. And it was like a, center spread of the sports section here, and it was them playing on kind of a very rugged rink. Real chippy ice and homemade boards, and it was a bunch of expats sort of posing for a photo with a bunch of Mongolian dudes, and I think that was probably where the seed was planted. And I believe what I did is I contacted the person who sort of had come across as the protagonist, or at least the motivator for that trip, a fellow who lived in Hong Kong at the time, who was a Canadian dude, and I found his, I don't know how circuitously how I ended up with his email, but I contacted him, and he was living in Hong Kong, and I told him that, I was interested in going to Mongolia and doing a sort of trip like that. And he told me, being in Hong Kong, that there was hockey there. So that was sort of the starting point for a lot of our journeys heading over there. I mean, sort of more philosophically, I guess, or spiritually or whatever, I had, become quite exhausted and fatigued with NHL hockey at the time. And I found that NHL hockey wasn't really kind of representative of the kind of hockey that I was playing just in my own life. It seemed like a very different sort of game. It seemed very kind of, it lacked a lot of the purity of the sport. So I wanted to go back to a place where, places where that hockey culture had really not been affected by NHL hockey. Well, what they were playing, the kind of game that they were playing, was a lot closer to kind of game as it had been played in the 30s and 40s in Canada than was being played right now. So that was kind of the motivating factor, I think, for going abroad.
And what were those, what are the differences specifically that the differences between the hockey?
Between what do you mean, from place to place,
No,
or
from like you were saying, like the they were playing a form of hockey that was more like Canada played in the 30s, and how is that different from the late 90s hockey that you kind of were disenchanted with?
well, just I think probably the kind of game that I was playing, with my friends was a lot more like the game as it was played in 1975. For instance, just one of the things, and I think this is kind of still endemic of the game today, you would never see a defenseman rush end to end with a puck, right? It's just not really done anymore. The hockey is a lot more clinical and systematic. Yet, so I would play with my friends, and we would do that all the time. And, it sort of struck me that the kind of game that I was playing just with my friends was, was just sort of more, it was more joyful somehow, and more playful, and more free in a lot of ways. And I wanted to sort of see if that game existed in that form elsewhere. And also, I think in terms of, listen, like anybody who makes the purpose of struggle to get there and has had an incredible journey, but you wouldn't really sort of know it to read about a player now. Everybody, players are so sort of micromanaged, and I think the hockey culture at a certain level is very micromanaged, and it's very, packaged and controlled in a lot of ways and spun a certain way. I guess I wanted to go to places as well where the culture of hockey was just sort of beginning to take shape, where there wasn't already sort of a template for it. And I think that's partly what I was after.
In the book, you talk a lot about how much you loved Wendell Clark. Do you, I mean, he was kind of the last of that breed. Do you watch a lot of the NHL these days? And if so, is there anybody out there who you think is kind of a throwback?
I do watch a lot of NHL hockey, and I had gone away from it for a long time. But now I do think the game is, I think the sense of sort of play and joy and speed, I think that is stuff has returned to the game. It was really bad in 96, 97. This was sort of when the game had become, very, very tight defensively and very systematic and overcoached. I think it's kind of creeping back in a little bit, but now I do think actually it's a little bit more like the game was tended to be played. And in terms of, I mean, I think there's a lot of, players like, Trevor Keane, Trevor Lewis, I think, for the Kings, and I think there was a large sort of, that team had a lot of support in those areas, very strong third and fourth line team.
Mm-hmm.
Nolan was played like that as well.
King.
Justin Penner. Say again?
That Dwight King guy kind of did.
Yeah, Dwight King, totally, absolutely. So there was a certain sort of quality, I think, to the way they sort of that they came. This sort of reminded me of, sort of prairie hockey player. Certainly not that they were all from the prairies, by any means. I think Dwight King is from Salt Lake City, right? But there was a certain element. I mean, Wendell was exceptional in a lot of ways because he was when he arrived in Toronto, he was a bit of a throwback player in the sense that he was, fearless, courageous, he hit, he fought, he scored. He played a kind of dominating hockey in sort of a humble way, in a very modest way, and that for me reminded me of players in the 60s and 70s and probably the 50s, and I don't really remember them. I just, when I was sort of starting to follow hockey, about a player like Phil Abs and Ted Kennedy and Tim Horton would have been quite old, but I knew that kind of player existed, and the whole Leaf legacy up until a certain point was really kind of overshadowed by players who had this really strong work ethic. I mean, the Leafs have never, you can just look, go, up and down and look at, war individual awards. The Leafs have never been heavy on that because the franchise has never really been about star players. It's always been a little bit more about foot soldiers, checking wingers and determined centermen and that sort of thing. So Wendell kind of embodied all of that. And just like in my life, too, I was experienced a bit of a sporting awakening when he kind of came along in 85. So I think everybody has a player like that in their life, and
right.
he was that dude for me.
One of the really interesting parts about the book was the Transylvania chapter. The history of Romanian hockey, you hear a lot about the Russian and, a little bit less about Czech and Finnish and Swedish, but the Romanian one was completely new to me.
It's a northern Romanian legacy. Yeah, I was astonished too when I'd been to the Middle East, in Dubai, United Arab Emirates, and I'd been to Hong Kong and all across China playing the game. But so when I came back, I was thinking, well, I'd like a third place. And one of the places actually that I kind of had listed as a destination was Ireland, which I think I should have been to school in Ireland in 85, and they played hockey in Dublin and in Belfast. So, but I needed another place, and I just literally thought to myself, gee, I wonder if they play hockey in Transylvania. And then it's remarkable, to find out that they've been playing there since 1933, and that in one of the towns, Mikriuchuk, the game is, their religion, really, in that city, where the rink is busy from, from 8 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night. I just got really lucky. I mean, I think you have to get a little bit lucky, especially when you're doing any sort of writing or any kind of work that's based on travel. You're hoping that you're going to find these little gems that are going to, come across, mm-hmm. Across your adventures, and this is one of the cases. And it was a fascinating place. And I feel quite a strong kind of cultural and emotional kinship. I've been back for the film version of the book. We went back there a second time, and I felt after that trip that I could run for mayor and probably get elected. They were so thrilled that I'd come, and since very grateful that I sort of documented their story for people like yourself and other readers, hockey fans, to appreciate.
Right. Another thing I liked that you talked about in the book was you talk about the smell of hockey, and I feel like anybody who plays in like a rec league or any kind of league, that smell, but it's not really talked about ever. So I liked seeing that laid out in a couple paragraphs.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to write a kind of book that smelled like hockey, I guess, in a way, right? I didn't want it to be antiseptic or anyway. I wanted it to sort of seem real, right? And, yeah, I'm glad that you know, readers like yourself can appreciate the smell of hockey, for better or worse. Not everybody likes it now.
Yeah. So I asked you a little bit about this earlier, but you said that you still follow it pretty closely, the NHL, and do you feel like it's become a little too commercial and kind of normal people have been priced out of games a little bit?
Yeah, that's certainly the case in Toronto, where, yeah, it's an expensive ticket, you know. Even in terms of the cost of a ticket at the time that I wrote that book, you know, it seemed absurd to me to pay $100, you know, to get into a hockey game. Well, now it's like $250, you know, for the best seat. So even that, even since the time the book has come out, the prices have, you know, they're increased to a grotesque proportion. So I think that's probably true here. I mean, and I think it may be true in other larger markets. I don't think that's necessarily true across the board, though. You can go to, like, Winnipeg, for instance, or Calgary, mm-hmm. or, and even Edmonton in Canada, and there's, you know, a myriad of cities across the states where you can, and not even necessarily mean struggling franchises either, but I remember going to a Tampa Bay Lightning game when I was there last spring, and it was relatively affordable. So, I think it has been kind of commercialized. I mean, in Toronto, it's, you know, it's, well, a lot of it is corporate seating and stuff that dominates for the most part, and you have to know somebody and know somebody else. You know, it shouldn't be that exclusive. That's why I think, another reason why I think kind of NHL hockey and hockey itself are quite different, you know. There's a lot of things that changed, and there's a lot of things that I think I wrote about in that book that I think I still apply today, you know, from just like in-game entertainment and the way the game is sort of presented, and how there are a lot of problems, I think, with the way hockey is just presented live.
Yeah.
So, for sure, there has been, you know, largely on Gary Bettman's watch as well, just in terms of the kind of identikit rings, you know, being uniform and every ring looks the same on television. It lacks some quality and character, the quality and character I used to have. I mean, trying to not be simply nostalgic, and, you know, somebody who disagrees with me probably, you know, accuse me of being nostalgic, but I've been around long enough, you know, to a point where I sort of have sort of seen both sides, and I can now just kind of evaluate for myself which side I think was actually superior or better.
Right.
Which time is better.
Do you think that the team is on the right track?
The Leafs?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do, actually, I do. I think certainly things are a lot more hopeful than really over the last 10 years. I mean, it's been a long time since the Leafs had any kind of farm system whatsoever, any kind of names, and we all know how it works with prospects. You know, many of them, well, most of them don't pan out, but at least there's, you know, there's a cupboard full now. You know, I think, Brian Burke probably with the Phil Kessel deal tried to make some sort of quick impact. He tried to turn around the team quickly. You know, it was a severe deal. You know, when you look at the two players who have gone Boston's way, but I kind of don't begrudge him for actually trying to make a splash. I think, in a way, you kind of have to give him a bit of a mulligan. I do feel that his last number of trades and some of his transactions and just the way he's assembled the team. I mean, listen, this team was in sixth place past Christmas even into the new year, and really they'd achieved something that no Leaf team in 15 years had really achieved in terms of where they were in the standing. And then something happened, as something always kind of happens, which isn't necessarily Brian Burke's fault. I think the team has been well assembled. But then again, it's tough to ask me a question with, and expect me to answer with any kind of clarity or any kind of ration, because, you know, it's like I'm dyed in the wool, and it's hard for really, you know, if I'm not positive, I'm stringing myself up. That's really the only two ways to fall. If I didn't feel hopeful, then I would feel totally desperate, and that's no fun.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to ask you about another book that you wrote, the Homeless World Cup. How did you come up with that idea? And if you could just talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I had. an editor in New York that I know who's published a few of my books before. He published Traveling Pocket in the States. He sent me a link to a New York Times story about the American homeless soccer team competing in the Homeless World Cup, or on their way to compete in the Homeless World Cup. And I thought to him, I wonder if there's a Canadian homeless team, and found out it was their main base of operation was literally like two blocks away from my house. Mm. So I got to know them and traveled with them to Melbourne, Australia for the 8th annual Homeless World Cup. Might be right. And wrote about their lives and wrote about the tournament, and I sort of embedded with them. I guess that's sort of the trendy way people describe themselves, writing about other people. But became quite close to them, got to know them really well. I'm on the board of Street Soccer Canada now, and just trying to get. It was an incredible experience because I met so many incredible people. 600 homeless athletes all in one place at one time. A thrilling, and even in a sporting sense too, like really quite inspiring to have people who, many of whom hadn't played sports much and had fallen on hard times, seeing them kind of back in the game was incredible. One of the athletes actually had been a Canadian soccer national and was addicted to OxyContins and painkillers and crack cocaine and fallen on very, very hard times. And when I came into the team, he had just started to get back into playing soccer at the rec center. And he was one of the players that I followed on Team Canada to Melbourne. And it was amazing to see sort of his transformation in his life. And now he actually just coaches all the teams in the program and stuff around here. So it was great. I feel very grateful and lucky to have been around those players.
So they do that every 4 years?
No, it's actually every year.
Oh, it is? Okay.
Yeah, this year's in Mexico City in October.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So do you still play in like an adult league or?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah?
Yep, absolutely. Same team.
How many rinks are there up there in the Toronto area? There's got to be hundreds, right?
Yeah, in the downtown metropolitan area, between outdoor and indoor, in the wintertime, there's 93. So in the summer, without outdoor ice, obviously, that number goes down to about 50 or something like that. But, yeah, it's crazy, and I've been to Russia a bunch of times and to Finland and the Russians, more so the Finns, so the Finns are always like, look at all the ice we have. And I was like, buddy. Toronto is just—it's nuts. It's we're really lucky to have so many great facilities and just so much neighborhood ice, and in a city that where there's such a large immigrant population, and new people from all around the world are coming here. There was just last year we had thousands of Roma kids here. Sort of the wave, the new sort of wave of that group of people came here, and I'd go to my neighborhood rink and there'd be kids who'd never seen ice before, like out there skating, and that's how you end up with hockey players, basically, right? We have all this ice in Toronto, but it's used. It's hard even for our rec league to get consistent ice time because it's in such demand. So. Brian Brooke calls it, the Vatican of hockey, which is completely hyperbolic in one way. I mean, it kind of is, just in terms of, the scope of the game, the imprint of the game on this city and this part of the province.
Mm-hmm. So what?
Where are you, Matt?
I'm in Kansas City.
Okay.
So we only have two rinks.
Right, fair enough.
So,
Yeah.
But we have a CHL team here called the Missouri Mavericks, and
okay.
So that there's a new rink there, and there's a practice rink in the same building. So that's where I play on Wednesday nights.
Right. Cool.
So obviously this is the Midwest, and it's just not very common for people to play down here.
Of course, yeah.
But
my team is involved in a tournament every year called the Exclaim Cup. I wrote a book called The Best Game You Can Name, which was my fourth or fifth book, but it was, I'd wanted to write two hockey books. When I first started writing, one was an international hockey book, one was a domestic hockey book. This is a domestic hockey book, but it basically follows tell the story of one game that my team plays in this tournament called the Exclaimed Cup, which happens every year. And the tournament is about 35 teams. It takes place on the Easter weekend, and teams from really all over the world come to play in it. And it's mostly artist teams, mm-hmm. right? So it's painters, actors. I mean, not exclusively that, obviously, but the team has kind of evolved from somebody who happens to be in the arts. It evolved sort of out of that. So mm-hmm. you guys should come. You should get a Kansas City representative.
It's in Toronto every year?
It is, yeah. It's in every Easter in Toronto. There's always room for more because the games take place on this weekend. They take place at like a fiveplex up here, basically. So there's a lot of ice time to go around. Okay. Yeah, but if you're interested, just let me know. I can hook you up with everybody who organizes and stuff. It's really fun.
What are you working on for future release?
Yeah, I have a memoir that I'm working on now. That is a hockey book. It's about Dave Keon's last season, 1974-75. And I was 11 that year. First year at, I'm not sure what you call it in the States, but for us it's like a middle school, like once you finish grade 5, you go to the middle school, 6, 7, and 8, mm-hmm. or high school. So, you know, it's sort of my first kind of, you know, year to new school, new kids, new thing. And it's the last year that this player played the Leafs. He's since been exiled. So he refuses to come back. Hmm. So it's kind of the book goes back and forth between my life as a Leaf fan as an 11-year-old and my life now, basically.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
I was looking at your website, and it looks like you also tour quite a bit with your band.
Yeah, I do.
Do you guys ever play in the States, or do you stay in Canada mostly?
Pretty much in Canada. We haven't been in the States in a while. My former band did, but it's been a while since we've been to America. But we'd like to. That's one of the things we're trying to get our stuff released down there, and hopefully we'll end up back in the States for sure.
Yeah, cool. All right, well, thanks a lot for taking the time to talk.
No problem. Yeah, anytime you want to talk hockey, give me a shout.
Cool, thank you.
Right on, Matt. And let me know when you have the link up. I can put it on my Facebook and all that kind of stuff.
All right, I will.
Okay, cheers.
See ya.